Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Tuesday, February 23rd, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, MISD Board Approves Intersessional Calendar, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland ISD Board approved a 2021-22 calendar leaders hope will be part of a solution that eventually brings more students back to reading on grade level. Midland ISD will go to an intersessional calendar that calls for weeks in the fall and spring when students needing intervention will have opportunity to get that help. During those weeks, those students not needing help will have a break. The calendar was approved after more than 2 hours of discussion, but the board voted 5-2 Monday to make the change from a traditional calendar. Board President Brian Murray and Katie Joyner voted against the calendar. Interim Superintendent Ann Dixon, who was charged to come up with the calendar, stated the move to an intersessional will be part of a strategy to improve academic performance and student outcomes. The process, she said, will include moving all elementary campuses to a phonetically based reading program. It will also include training Midland ISD personnel, so-called reading angels, to oversee the program, identify students needing intervention, and work with teachers on campuses across the district. Dixon said all elementary school level would get that extra help. She said it is at the elementary school level where a student's reading foundation is developed, and that two-thirds of the campuses either failed or received a grade of D from the Texas Education Agency. It was also stated by district leaders that those students who are not reading on grade level would not automatically be promoted to the next grade, as has been the case during recent years. It was stated that earned promotion will be the teeth to get more students needing reading help onto campuses during the intersessional weeks. The debate featured points from Joyner, who said she didn't want people to have to pick between Disney World and having to be on campus. She said once it became apparent that the traditional calendar was not going to pass, she hoped the district would just have one intersessional week and warm into the intersessional concept. She also said she wasn't aware of the data that showed the intersessional calendar's success elsewhere. Rick Davis said he remembered conversations with officials from Socorro ISD in the El Paso area and that they talked about how wonderful the intersessional calendar is and how students would benefit from it. That should be our governing goal, Davis said, of students benefiting from decisions made by the board. Davis said the whole purpose intersessional calendar is to reach kids when they need help, and 2 weeks helps close those learning gaps in the fall and winter. Davis said he is confident that the calendar will be one part of a plan and that the new superintendent, Angelica Ramsey, would make sure the reading program is revamped and the reading specialists are properly trained. This is a wholesale change that is much needed, Davis said. Particulars on the calendar included a start date on August 2nd, an end date before Memorial Day, May 27th, an intersessional week in October, and a second one in February. This article is entitled Murray, Student Outcomes, Culture to Shape MISD's Identity. Editor's note, this is the second part of a question and answer with Midland ISD Board President Brian Murray by Stuart Doreen. Improving student outcomes has been a focus of the Midland ISD School Board as the calendar turned to 2021. That can be seen in the following question and answer with Board President Brian Murray. He addressed the identity of the district, whether the district is better equipped for success with the arrival of a new superintendent, professional learning communities, online learning, and communication with the public. And improving student outcomes is a big part of the message offered. Reporter Telegram. Define what you believe the identity of the district to be. Murray. I believe the identity of the district should be about all our students. Our mission is that all students will graduate prepared and ready for college or career. As a board, we have set goals that focus on reading during the early educational years, being at or above grade level at math and reading during the middle years, and graduating at the culmination of the public school experience. Our identity is determined by our student outcomes and shaped by the culture we have on campuses. Our campuses are the backbone of our identity, and we must support and professionally develop our teachers and campus administrators. Ultimately, to succeed with student outcomes, we rely on teachers to do the work, and I consider them our biggest asset. All these workings are wrapped in a community that is supportive and willing to share of their time and treasures. Reporter Telegram. Is this district better equipped for success now than it was before the previous superintendent began? If so, why? Murray. In my opinion, the district is better equipped for success as Dr. Angelica Ramsey starts her term as superintendent. The district has made some progress, financial stability is a main example, has made some mistakes, and will be better because we can learn from these mistakes. Dr. Ramsey brings a strong background in academic. She will place focus on building systems that will provide a foundation for learning, starting with our youngest learners, by placing an emphasis on a district-wide reading program. She will be present on campuses, as we learned through the interview process, that she likes to spend 2 days a week visiting campuses and seeing the needs and identifying supports in person. She will change the expectation for our student outcomes, and I believe will change the overall culture of the district. There will also be changes at central office. We all know that change is hard, but will be beneficial as we seek to focus every person employed by the district on improving student outcomes. The district will emerge stronger. Reporter Telegram. What are the plans going forward for the system of great schools approach the board adopted 3 or so years ago? What changes, if any, might the board consider? Murray. As of today, I have not been a part of or heard any discussion to change the original 10-year plan for the system of great schools as a theory of action. The initial plan was to move from managed instruction, central office lead, to earned autonomy, district building internal leaders to run campuses, to a system of great schools, campus ran autonomously and only using central office as requested. The reasoning underlying these theories of actions was in each step student outcomes were to improve, the main thing. In my opinion, the administration was so focused on working toward the 10-year plan that they failed to focus on the main thing. Again, in my opinion, student outcomes will improve as we develop our campus leaders and our teachers. We must provide supports for each campus to be successful and create a culture that a campus can ask for help and receive it, knowing we are all focused on improving student outcomes. A true system of great schools involves all MISD taking ownership in our student outcomes and being prepared to provide supports and development as requested. Reporter Telegram. The PLC, Professional Learning Communities Initiative, was initiated with a certain fanfare several years ago. What is the current status of that initiative, and are there plans to lay it down, expand it, or keep it about the same as it is now? Murray, I believe professional learning communities are very much alive in our district and can be a great tool when administered properly. I believe recently our PLCs became more about compliance than as properly intended for learning. The goal of PLCs was always to increase student outcomes. Students benefit from teachers being able to share ideas about what has proven to work and pitfalls to avoid on a student-by-student basis. Teachers can benefit through professional development from their peers and discussions about independent student needs. During the superintendent interview process, Dr. Ramsey had refreshing thoughts on PLCs, and I look forward to her sharing her input and getting the process back on track. I very much believe that PLCs are beneficial to our students. Reporter Telegram. Once the pandemic has passed, what type of online presence, if any, do you think MISD might continue with? And how might that play out? E.g., online-only instruction versus combining online students with classroom students, percentage of students educated online, etc. Murray. I believe online learning is an idea to explore for the future. I do think the opportunities will be limited once the pandemic is over. The district must plan and go through the proper steps with the TEA before any future online earning is endorsed. There is work going on now to create 200 online seats at Coleman High School for secondary students, as well as several other exciting opportunities. There are several factors to explore when considering online learning. Is there a community appetite? Are there teachers willing to do this work? Do we have an approved campus from the state? Have we planned for attendance controls and monitoring? Do we have a good curriculum to ensure that our students will be successful in their education? I think online learning could be a future possibility, but the district will have to be exhaustive in the preparations. Reporter Telegram. Is communication between the district and the community where it needs to be? Murray. The communication between the district and the community can always be better. It requires continuous attention. MISD has a great communication department, and I believe this is one area that the district has improved dramatically. The board must also be intentional about sharing details about district issues as they arise. During the meetings we held to hear from those who opposed the bond, we heard time and time again that communication was an important issue. I know board members, including myself, have used social media, held or attended community meetings, and answered many emails in an effort to be more transparent and to gain community input. The district and the board will continue to listen, communicate, and look for ways to improve. This article is entitled Community Members to Offer Insight on How to Serve by Stuart Doreen. On Wednesday, the Reporter Telegram starts an awesome journey with 10 community members who want to talk more about our community and what the Reporter Telegram can do better for our readers. Those 10 are, in alphabetical order, Matt Galindo, Pastor Doug Lamb, Latoya Mayberry, Roy Nelson, Lucy Cisniega, Carla Smith, Kristen Vasquez, Stephen Viela, Kate Williamson, and Pastor Darren Wood. We will talk about Midland, what makes it special, what is going well, and what could be better. There will not be a political group, nor will it be an editorial board like the Reporter Telegram has put together in the past. Theirs will be voices that help a community move forward. They will tell the Reporter Telegram how we can serve the community better, all of it. It is an exciting opportunity to talk issues including education, government, the church, philanthropy, and other issues that impact the community. There are no elected officials, but there are people who have run for leadership positions and others who have shown a passion for their community. There also are four who lead or are crucial figures in their respective churches. In addition, we have business leaders to help provide direction. We are pleased that this group will come together, maybe as often as once a month, to provide direction for our community and your newspaper. Where do we fall short? What do we want to see more of? How do we do better to tell the story of Midland? And when each has something to say about our community, they will have access to our space to write what the community needs to read. The possibilities are an endeavor unparalleled in this newspaper's history. We believe we know this community well, but it is certain our knowledge will improve. What should you expect? If we are successful, more coverage of not only what happened, but what it means and why it was important. For instance, this past week, there was plenty of information about the cold weather's impact on Midland. But our readers also found out about efforts by Carl Borowski and True Light Fellowship to take care of Midlanders as temperatures dropped and the needs of a community increased. That is the news we believe you want more of. Sometimes that news is referred to as good news. In most cases, it shows Midland at its best. We can do more. We will do better. This is the local page. This article is entitled, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick Visits Midland Following Power Grid Debacle, by Caitlin Randall. Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick stopped in several cities Monday, including Midland, to discuss investigations that will begin later this week into statewide power outages following what he described as a Cat 5 ice storm. Those investigations will look for answers into why millions of Texans were left without electricity for days, despite utility companies' assurances that controlled outages would rotate, Patrick said during a briefing with news media. We will leave no stone unturned, he said. I'm taking the responsibility of the fix on my shoulders as president of the Senate. I am not going to take a bill that doesn't get the job done, whatever that is. We're working on the short term and the long term. He said it was too early to tell what changes to the grid system might be needed, and he will likely create a special committee to investigate beyond the hearings scheduled for Thursday and Friday. The lieutenant governor continued attacks from other Republican lawmakers on renewable energy sources, saying the Electric Reliability Council of Texas had said they were prepared for the record-breaking freeze, but overestimated how much energy could be produced from wind turbines. ERCOT estimated that turbines would account for 12 to 15% of energy produced for the grid, but after they froze and were knocked offline, wind plants instead accounted for only 4 to 8%, according to Patrick. If there's one lesson America and Texas should learn about this is you can't count on renewable energy to be reliable in the worst of times, he said, adding that he wasn't pointing fingers. Patrick said he was meeting with several people in the oil and gas industry while in Midland before heading to Lubbock after stopping in Houston, Dallas, and Abilene earlier in the day. He said the Permian Basin is the heart and soul of cheap and reliable energy in Texas. We have a reliable core of energy that does not depend on wind or solar for emergency times. The Permian Basin protects the whole country, he said. This is who we have to count on, or we won't have heat and lights or an affordable price for any Americans if the left Green New Deal folks get their way. When asked why he was critical of wind and solar plants going offline while natural gas and coal plants also failed, Patrick said gas and coal producers were able to restart generation more easily than renewable sources. The people who got their lights back on and the heat back on didn't get it from a windmill or solar panel, he said. They got it from reliable fossil fuel energy. President Joe Biden on Saturday signed a major disaster declaration for 77 Texas counties. Midland and Ector counties were not included in the declaration. Patrick said he was disappointed by that decision and believed the declaration should have been for all 254 counties in Texas. U.S. Representative August Pfluger sent a letter to Biden on Monday that was signed by 27 Texas representatives asking the president to expand his disaster declaration. We fear that your initial Federal Emergency Management Agency declaration falls far short of the actual needs of our state and requests the immediate approval of all 254 Texas counties for individual assistance, the letter states. This article is entitled, Doris J's Kitchen is Family Dream Come True, Serves Special Menu for Lent, by J.C. Lewis. Doris J's Kitchen is a family-owned restaurant that opened in Midland last October at 4200 West Illinois Avenue, Suite 160. The restaurant is a family dream of three generations, and they specialize in soul food and Southern comfort food. My grandparents were head chefs at Ranchland Hills Country Club, co-owner Isaac Brown said. The vision started when my parents and that generation were kids. They always talked about starting a restaurant. Me being in the third generation, I just so happened to love to cook, and I love food, so I shared that vision with them. The family got the opportunity to move into the old Chinese kitchen. Co-owners include Brown, his mother Angelica Govan, and father Brandon Govan, Aunt Royal Sanders, Uncle Marcus Miller, and uncle, as well as head chef, Derek Brown. Angelica said they named the restaurant after her grandmother and mother-in-law. Our grandmother is Doris Jane, and my mother-in-law is Doris Jean, she said. We did a family vote, and everybody voted for Doris J's, because we are here because of the Dorises. The family grew up making these dishes, but head chef Derek Brown put his own spin on the recipes as well. He was a chef at a Marriott in Dallas before the pandemic hit. It was an opportunity for me to show the world what I can do, Derek said, what my talents are and what my flavor is. I'm doing everything I've dreamt about doing for me. Popular dishes include oxtails, smothered neck bones, fried pork chops, fried chicken, and meatloaf. The DJ Burger is their most popular burger, and it is served with sautéed onions and mushrooms, cheese, lettuce, tomatoes, pickles. Then customers can choose fries or okra. The restaurant also offers a Southwest vegan burger. We serve oxtails 2 days a week, so if people don't get there early for the oxtails, more than likely we will run out of them, Derek said. During the season of Lent, the restaurant is serving up a lot more fish dishes. Isaac said the new popular dish will probably be the salmon rice bowl. The restaurant will also be serving salmon croquettes, catfish sandwiches, blackened catfish, and grilled catfish. Redfish tacos will be coming within a week, Derek said. He said they have hired a chef from the Bahamas as the lead cook, Michael Wims. He is bringing a lot of Bahamian favors to our kitchen, and he has brought a Bahamian friend, Bahamian fried catfish flavor, which we will be serving during Lent. Derek has been living in Fort Worth and driving to Midland on Wednesday to work, then heads back to Fort Worth on Sunday. Since he has been commuting, he trained Isaac to work the grill, and now Isaac has learned every recipe. Royal Sanders also lives in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but the family decided to open a restaurant in Midland because they were all raised here, and this is where they saw an opportunity, she said. It has absolutely been a dream of our parents, and we are so excited to be living this out, Sanders said. Angelica added that it has been an awesome endeavor. Not only just a journey together, but it might give other families hope that anybody can come together, do business together, and love each other, Angelica said. So when people come in, they feel like our family. Derek said this allows the siblings who don't live in Midland to visit with their parents and check in on them. Their parents living in Midland were a major motivator to open the restaurant. Ernest Brown, Derek's father, is considered the restaurant's business consultant. Derek's mother, Francine Brown, worked the first day the restaurant opened, but decided she would like to relax instead of working. The owners have applied for a food and beverage permit, which they hope to be approved in a couple of weeks. And once approved, they plan to serve beer, wine, and create a daiquiri bar. The restaurant has two entrances, one for takeout and one for dine-in. Hours of operation are 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Saturday and 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday. Temporarily closed. Clear Springs Restaurant, 5707 Andrews Highway, temporarily closed after the winter storm. The restaurant has posted signage about the closure and two dumpsters are placed outside. The restaurant donated food to Breaking Bread Ministries on Friday, according to a Facebook post by Breaking Bread Ministries. Clear Springs Restaurant was able to fill the ministry's 15-passenger van with prepared meals and pantry items. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled, Biden Gets Tongue Twisted at Town Hall, by Ruben Navarrete, Washington Post writers. President Joe Biden joked that sometimes he wakes up in the White House and asks his wife Jill, where the hell are we? I believe it. The 78-year-old probably has many such moments. I've been in the communications business for 30 years. God didn't give me an artistic, athletic, mechanical, or musical skill, but he did give me the ability to get my point across. There are jobs you can't do if you can't communicate effectively, such as President of the United States. One needs to be able to talk to the American people in simple and clear language. That's why Biden's disastrous appearance this week at the CNN town hall in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was worrisome. It's not enough to say the career politician has lost his fastball. He's throwing wild. I winced through the event. I want Biden to succeed. To do that, he needs to be able to put two sentences together. To the degree that Biden sometimes struggles to do this, some of the blame might belong to the aging process. When I posted that on Facebook, baby boomers, who are appropriately named because they act like infants, got triggered. Apparently, I'm an ageist. The Woodstock generation that once warned us not to trust anyone over 30 now tells us not to criticize anyone pushing 80. It's a shame the flower children wilt so easily. At 79, my father is 6 months older than Biden. The career cop who spent 37 years on the job was once a master storyteller and strong public speaker. He aced oral exams, spoke at Rotary clubs, and taught college classes. Today, he struggles to make his way from the start of a sentence to the end, especially when he is under stress. During the CNN town hall, I counted from Biden no fewer than a dozen stemminders, half sentences, mistakes, lost trains of thought, non sequiturs, and streams of consciousness. CNN fact-checkers, who I thought were taking the next 4 years off, found at least four untruths that Biden told regarding vaccines, China, illegal immigrants, and the minimum wage. If pro-Biden CNN conceded four falsehoods, there were probably many more. Most politicians are skilled at not answering a question, but we need to worry when one appears to forget what the question was. When asked by an audience member what he intended to do about white supremacy, Biden talked about how he got into politics because of civil rights and opposition to white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan, and said he would make sure that my Justice Department and the Civil Rights Division is focused heavily on those very folks. What a flat and uninspiring answer. Biden then took a gratuitous poke at Trump and called white supremacy a bane on our existence. The phrase is bane of our existence. It's cool for a president to be folksy, but red flags should go up when he gets stuck in Mayberry. This wasn't an ice cream social. At the first town hall of the Biden presidency, and maybe the last one for a long time, if protective White House aides have their way, the goal was to reassure Americans as we go from one calamity to another. After the town hall, a liberal commentator conceded that the president rambled. At least Biden had a chummy moderator. CNN's Anderson Cooper tossed softballs, i.e., what's it like to live in the White House? He gave Biden the correct answer to an immigration question, i.e., just to be clear, you do want a path to citizenship for roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants, and that would be essential in any bill for you? He even brushed past a condescending comment from Biden about how not everybody in the Hispanic and African American community know how to get online to determine how to get in line for that COVID vaccination. That comment harkened back to a Democratic primary debate in September 2019 when Biden, in response to a question about repairing the legacy of slavery, said he wanted to bring social workers into homes and parents to help them deal with how to raise their children because they don't quite know what to do.
Thanks to the media, Biden will continue to get by with a lot of help from his friends. But his enablers can only cover up so much. We are, after all, talking about a politician who, after half a century in the game, loves to talk, but no longer does it as well as he used to. How long can Team Biden keep something like that under wraps? Sooner or later, it's going to be a problem. I'd bet on sooner. This column is called Opinion Extra. It is entitled, Ted Cruz Wants to Be a Populist, but He Can't Get It Right, by Joel Stein, special to the Washington Post. Ted Cruz wants to be a populist. He's read all the manuals about how normal Americans think, dress, act, and talk, but he can't quite get the moves right. He got a mullet, which is brilliant anti-elitist behavior, but he screwed it up. Getting a haircut that is business in the front, but barely 2 months of pandemic in the back. He grows a beard like the survivalists do, but styles it like a kombucha salesman. Born Raphael, Cruz calls himself Ted, which is just shy of a real populist name like Chase or Blake or Squee. 4 years ago, Cruz liked a porn video on Twitter. That's not the same strong populist game as having sex with a porn star and then paying her off to keep quiet about it in a way that will make sure every person on earth knows about it. But it's a start. Then Cruz fumbled the moment and blamed the staff for pressing like on his Twitter account. When asked what his favorite movies are, he named the Godfather trilogy. I like Godfather 3, he said. I actually thought it was a wonderful culmination of Michael Corleone. When Cruz tries to talk about normal stuff, he sounds like Borat. Cruz understood that calling someone a snowflake is a cruel insult to level at your enemies. Then he named his own dog Snowflake. That's like a normal person naming his dog Ted Cruz. But it looked as though he finally nailed the populist costume when he took off for Cancun from Houston as people in Texas burned their furniture during power failures amid the lowest temperatures in decades. Cancun is spot-on populist. It's a town where early last year a hotel offered drunk yoga. Cruz claimed he went there because his daughters wanted a vacation. If the daughter of anyone I know said she wanted to go to Cancun, her parents would search for excuses to say no. They'd blurt out something about crime or tell them that college admissions directors subscribed to Senior Frog's Instagram page. Cruz didn't need any of those excuses to reject his daughter's request for an international vacation. All he had to say was pandemic. He didn't have to mention leadership, responsibility, or people sleeping in their cars. But he really blew it when he booked his rooms at the Ritz-Carlton. A real populist does not stay at a Ritz-Carlton. A real populist stays at Secrets, Dreams, Temptation, or the Fiesta Americana. Or better yet, a buddy's pull-out couch at Secrets, Dreams, Temptation, or the Fiesta Americana. Despite having a rolling suitcase, Cruz said he was just flying to Cancun to drop off his daughters. We know the whole drop-off thing was false because we've seen Cruz's wife Heidi's group text chat planning the trip with some Houston friends. A populist doesn't have friends who leak texts to an editor at the New York Times because a populist's friends don't know any editors at the New York Times. But his giveaway error was backing down. After he got caught, he changed his return ticket and flew back to Texas on standby and acknowledged his, quote, mistake, unquote. And then he apologized for crossing the border to provide a better life for his family. Donald Trump would never admit a mistake. He would have said instead that while Joe Biden had secretly gone on a trip to Ukraine, he was going to the Ritz-Carlton Cancun to get a sweet deal on decorations for his beautiful border wall. Trump would have said that the whole story was fake news, a socialist hoax to distract from frozen wind farm cancer. The point is, Trump would not have made sense. Cruz's dilemma is that he needs the votes of people who are nothing like him. He's cerebral and devoid of instinct, so he overthinks what a populist would do, works out 30 steps to get there, and winds up in the populist uncanny valley, which is a never-ending flight back and forth to Cancun. By Joel Stein, special to the Washington Post. This column is entitled Senator Ted's Excellent Mexican Adventure by Ken Herman, Austin American Statesman. Senator Ted Cruz and family headed to Cancun on Wednesday while millions of Texans who made the mistake of not being U.S. senators were hunkered down and following advice, including from Cruz, to avoid travel, as if they could travel even if they wanted to. Guilty, Cruz says, with an excuse. Like millions of Texans, he said in a Thursday statement after fellow travelers Wednesday tweeted photos of him at a Houston airport and on a Cancun-bound flight, our family lost heat and power too. Yes, we feel your discomfort. Hundreds of thousands of Texans still without power, millions having to boil their water, Texans suffering, Texans dying. So what's a senator to do in these conditions? Cancun. But again, with an excuse. Blame the kids. Oh, like you've never blamed the kids. With school canceled for the week, our girls asked to take a trip with friends, Cruz said in a statement. Wanting to be a good dad, I flew down with them last night and am flying back this afternoon. My staff and I are in constant communication with state and local leaders to get to the bottom of what happened in Texas. We want our power back, our water on, and our homes warm. And some of us would love to take the kids to Cancun with their friends. Some of us also might have used this as a teaching moment, as in, sure, kids, you would like to go to Cancun, but this is not the best time to travel, you know, cold, COVID, stuff like that. There also was this from Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, who said Cruz's staff contacted the Houston Police Department for help getting through Houston's George Bush Intercontinental Airport. HPD officers monitored his movements through the terminal, Acevedo said. I know what you're thinking. Asking for emergency responders to help a senator navigate an indoor airport during a statewide disaster might not be the optimal use of tax dollars. I'm thinking I like the way you're thinking. We're all thinking. What was Cruz thinking? And whether he was thinking. The photos of Cruz at the airport and on the Cancun-bound plane circulated long before Cruz fessed up to the trip. Odds are good the photos are why Cruz fessed up to the trip. Looks like he's had the beard long enough that it no longer serves as a disguise. We also must recall that back in December, after Austin Mayor Steve Adler took a dumb trip to Cabo in connection with his daughter's wedding, while he told fellow Austinites to stay home because of the pandemic, Cruz was among those who piled on with richly deserved criticism. Hypocrites, he tweeted over a screenshot of a CNN story that said, "Damn officials caught not following their own guidelines." Complete and upper hypocrites, Cruz tweeted December 2nd. And don't forget Mayor Adler, who took a private jet with 8 people to Cabo, and while in Cabo recorded a video telling Austinites to stay home if you can. This is no time to relax. A follow-up Cruz tweet said, and that's to say nothing of the disaster Mayor Adler is responsible for in Austin, with homelessness and murder rates skyrocketing. Earlier this week, Cruz retweeted weather warnings and added cautions of his own. Stay safe and stay warm. Everybody need to take this storm very seriously. The storm is very dangerous. Please be careful and be safe. In a Monday radio interview, he said, we could see 100 people lose their lives this week in Texas, so don't risk it. Keep your family safe and just stay home and hug your kids. Or, if possible, help them pack for Cancun. And actually, most Texans didn't have to be told to stay home during this disastrous snow event. Most of us know enough to stay home during a disastrous snow event, even if it means hunkering down, holing up and bundling up for a few days in an unheated home. Not our junior senator. And maybe you'd do just what he did if you suffered from the arrogance of elected office. No, you wouldn't. But there he was, cruising high above the little bit of international border wall his buddy Donald Trump is so proud of. Memo to Trump, who referred to Cruz as Lion Ted during the 2016 presidential primary. If we get Trump versus Cruz 2 in 2024, feel free to call him Flying Ted. We welcome Cruz's return to Texas. I think that our Canadian-born senator might be helpful in a snow emergency. This is the obituary column, Tuesday, February 23rd, 2021. David Harper Essex. On February 13, 2021, David Harper Essex passed away from injuries sustained in a one-vehicle accident near Menard, Texas. David was 68 years old. David was born on November 9, 1952, in Fort Worth, Texas, and his parents were Barbara and Frank Essex. David is survived by his sister, Hollis, Holly Reimers, and husband, Delbert, of Orland, California. Daughters Elise Louise Ansley and husband Mark, and their children Mason and Oliver of Frisco, Texas. And daughter Hillary Essex Armstrong and husband Jared, and their children Jack and Wyatt of Austin, Texas. Grandchildren of his late son, David Harper Essex Jr., Elliot and Pierce of Denver, Colorado. Stepson William Thomas Brown, the second, Bill, and wife Allison, with their children Grace Ann, Will, Lily, and Carolyn of Lakeway, Texas. Stepdaughter Bliss Brown Nowert, and children Haley, Jake, and Kyle of Rockwall, Texas, and his girlfriend Teresa Hansen of Midland, Texas. A celebration of David's life will be held at Midland Country Club on February 24th, 2021, from 2 to 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests donations to Gladney Center for Adoption, 6300 John Ryan Drive, Fort Worth, Texas, 76132, or to Midland Shared Spaces, 3500 North 8th Street, Suite 1100, Midland, 79705, or to a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Holly Hawkins Lazari. Holly Hawkins Lazari of Midland, Texas, joined our Heavenly Father on Sunday, February 14, 2021, at the age of 47. Holly was born in Sweetwater, Texas, on July 30, 1973, but called Midland home for much of her life. Holly is survived by her son, Case Martin, and his girlfriend, Katie Tettleton, of Stillwater, Oklahoma, daughter, Jaden Lazari, of Edmond, Oklahoma, sister, Kelly Ferguson, and husband, Ben, of Midland, brother, Justin Hawkins, of Midland, sister, Jamie Cole, and husband, Tommy, of Midland, nephews, Montgomery Light, Caden Light, Brody Cole, and niece, Regan Cole. Holly was preceded in death by her parents, John and Jerry Hawkins. The family will receive friends on Monday, February 22nd from 5 to 7 p.m. at Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Tuesday, February 23rd at Mid-Cities Church, Neely Campus, followed by interment at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. James Walter Owen Jr. James Walter Owen Jr., Papa, 76, of Midland, Texas, passed away on February 17th at Midland Memorial Hospital in Midland. Walter was born on September 16, 1944, to J.W. and Gladys Marie Johnson Owen in Louisville, Arkansas. He married Sharon Sue Walls on January 27, 1984. He is survived by his spouse, Sharon Sue Owen of Midland, three children, Randy Owen, Tracy Binion, Chris, and Sarah Carey, Josh of Midland, six grandchildren, and three siblings, Arnold Ray Owen, Mary Bunch, and Sherry Patterson, one great-granddaughter, three great-grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his parents, J.W. and Gladys Marie Owen, and one brother, Roy Lee Owen. A celebration of life will be held on Tuesday, February 23rd at 2 p.m. at American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Joe Taylor Smith. Joe Taylor Smith, 87, passed away Saturday, February 20th, 2021. Joe was born on a family farm in the small community of McAuley, Texas. His parents, Alice and Adley Stevenson Smith, and his siblings welcomed his arrival on November 23, 1933. He is survived by his children, David Absher Corbett, Pam, and Bradley Joe Smith, Tricia. He is also survived by numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. His wife of 50 years, Patricia Ann Smith, preceded him in death in July 2019. He was also preceded in death by his parents, his two brothers, A.S. Bud Smith, Bill and wife Nita Smith, and two sisters, Helen Smith Allen, husband Claude, and LaRue Smith Geisler and husband Doug. Joe is survived by one sister-in-law, Edna Smith, survived by two stepsons, William Rawl Brown, Chris Brown, and wife Brenda, and granddaughters April Brown, Gavin, and Kristen Brown. Surviving him also are numerous nieces and nephews. He was lovingly cared for by his niece, Beverly Armstrong, and husband Rick. Joe was also survived by his dear and best friend, David Adams, with whom he shared many years of friendship. A visitation will be on Tuesday, February 23rd, at Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home from 5 to 6:30 p.m. A graveside service will be at Rest Haven Memorial Park, Wednesday, February 24th at 11 a.m. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation to Mark Empowering Lives, 2701 North A Street, Midland, 79705, or West Texas Boys Ranch, 10223 Boys Ranch Road, San Angelo, Texas, 76904, or a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Larry Albert Carroll. Larry Albert Carroll, 69, of Midland, went to be with the Lord on Wednesday, February 17, 2021. A celebration of life will be held for family and friends at a later date. Larry was born on January 9, 1952, in Roanoke, Virginia, to Albert William and Frances Carroll. Those left to cherish his memory are his loving wife of 36 years, Elizabeth Morrow Carroll, his children Jenny Royer and husband Dana of Middletown, Connecticut, Jonathan Carroll and wife Julia Springfield, Maryland, Jeanette Whitus and husband Brent of Burnett, Texas, and grandchildren Michaela and Riley Whitus of Burnett, Texas, Cole and Heath Royer of Middletown, Connecticut. Also left with countless memories are his brother John Carroll and wife Virginia of Louisa, Virginia, and sister Tricia Carroll Knighton of Christiansburg, Virginia, sisters-in-law Gula Morrow Robertson and Margaret Morrow Thibodeau, along with several nieces, nephews, cousins, and friends. Larry was preceded in death by his parents, Albert and Frances Carroll, and many loving aunts and uncles. In lieu of flowers, donations in his memory may be made to PermiaCare, Midland Community Bible Study, Midland Soup Kitchen, or First Baptist Church of Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Patsy Winnell Barker. Patsy 1L Barker stepped from this life into eternity on February 18, 2021. Patsy was born on September 19, 1931 in Wheeler, Texas. Patsy is preceded in death by her parents, two brothers, and her beloved Bill. She is survived by one brother, her sister, her daughter, Becky Bryant, her son, Danny, and wife, Diana, her grandkids, Tiffany and husband, Bobby, Nicole and husband, Ross, Dustin and wife, Meredith, Casey, Drew, and wife, Ashton, Dylan and wife, Dana, and her great-grandkids, Tyler, Braden, Peyton, Brenna, Hope, Asher, Kyle, Haston, Wiley, Hagen, Bristow, and Easton. She will be missed by all, especially her family. We ask that donations may be made to Kaleidoscope Ministry, where she served faithfully for many, many years. https://midlandkm.com/donate/. Visitation was held at Naomi Picklinwell's funeral home from 6 to 7 p.m. on Sunday the 21st. The funeral was held at First Baptist Church Chapel on Monday the 22nd at 2 p.m. Arrangements are under the direction of Naomi Picklinwell's funeral home and crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Robert Christopher White. Robert Christopher White, age 51, passed on to be with our Lord on February 18, 2021. Memorial service will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, February 24th at Naomi Picklinwell's Funeral Home Chapel. Chris was born July 7, 1969, and was raised in Midland, Texas. He graduated from Midland High School in 1987. In 2018, Chris moved to Brownwood, Texas, to live his dream of living on the lake. Chris loved fishing and spending time with his dog, Abby. He is survived by his two sons, Alex White and Justin White, his parents, C.M., Buzzy, and Gail White, his sister, Dana LaBombard, and her husband, Brian, his brother, Shannon White, and his wife, Sean, along with four nieces, one nephew, nine great-nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his grandparents, C.F. Aubrey, Treva Aubrey, and Bill and Nell White, and his beloved dog, Buster. Arrangements are under the direction of Naomi Picklinwell's Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Cruz Esquivel. Cruz Esquivel, 75, of Midland, passed away February 20th. Rosary will be held at 7 p.m. Thursday, February 25th at the branch at NPW in Midland. Funeral Mass will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, February 26th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, with interment following at Fairview Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Naomi Picklinwell's Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Lovey Joanne Robertson. Lovey Joanne Robertson of Midland, Texas, passed away on Monday, February 15th. Services will be held at 2 p.m. on Saturday, February 27th at Naomi Picklinwell's Funeral Home Chapel in Midland. Survivors include son George Galloway Robertson. Arrangements are under the direction of Naomi Picklinwell's Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Natividad Venegas Carrillo. Natividad Venegas Carrillo, 75, of Odessa, passed away on Saturday, February 20th. Natividad is survived by wife Gloria Flores Venegas, sons Harvey, Tati, Mauricio, Neri, Gustavo Venegas, two brothers and two sisters. Visitation begins at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, February 23rd at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Burial will be held at a later date in Mexico. Paula Neal. Paula Neal, 62, of Midland, passed away February 19th. Celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, February 26th at Naomi Picklinwell's Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Arrangements
are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welsh Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelsh.com. Ramona Mona Carrasco Gonzalez. Ramona Mona Carrasco Gonzalez, 77, of Midland, passed away on Monday, February 15th. The viewing will be held on Wednesday, February 24th, from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Rosary will be recited Wednesday evening at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass is set for Thursday, February 25th at 10 a.m. at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial will follow at Rest Haven North. She is survived by one son, Eulalio R. Eddie, or Chuchu Gonzalez, two daughters, Grace Mata and Diana Gonzalez, five grandchildren, seven great-grandchildren, and numerous nieces and nephews.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.